We just came through several weeks of talking about kind of early Buddhist foundational teachings, precepts and refuges, characteristics of things, and talked last week about dana, the practice of giving. One of the other foundational practices, and we'll move into now some time where I'm going to kind of weave my way into a set of teachings called the Ten Parami, or the perfections. These are qualities of heart or being that are considered to be a kind of pillars on the path, qualities to develop. And talk tonight about friendliness, or loving kindness is the usual translation. The Pali word in the language of the early Buddhist texts is metta, and the Sanskrit version of that is maitri, often translated as friendliness. And this is a quality of heart. It's considered to be the kind of paradigmatic or the cornerstone quality of heart. And it opens into the other heart qualities of compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. And it's considered to be among the most important qualities to develop on the path. And in a sense, it balances in a beautiful way the qualities of equanimity or balance, dispassion, renunciation, wisdom that sees all things as arising and passing, all of the kind of austere or letting go oriented aspects of practice. The proposition that things are selfless or without permanent essence, all of which can be a little dry, perhaps, sounding. Then comes the teaching on metta, that one teacher says just like waters the heart, brings moisture or sweetness to the heart. And we did a basic practice of metta in the meditation, a version of metta just based on the breath, where one recognizes one's own basic goodness. Basic goodness is a sweet term I'm borrowing from the Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa. And one of the doorways I really love for recognizing or tuning into basic goodness is sincerity. And I like sincerity because it, I think, has the possibility, at least, the power to cut through some of the ideas we might have about ourselves, especially the critical ones. And you might have some of those. If you're like me. Or anyone else around here. In the earliest texts, there's a verse that says, ostensibly of the Buddha, that says, I looked through the whole universe and found no one dearer than myself. And often Western practitioners will sometimes say, that's not my experience. I looked through the whole universe and I found no one more objectionable than myself. And we live in a culture that I think has taught us, actively teaches us, self-loathing almost as a cornerstone of capitalism. What would it be like to not doubt our own worth as a being? This verse, I looked through the universe and found no one dearer than myself, suggests not a kind of like, oh, I'm better than everyone sort of narcissism. It simply suggests, I think, a recognition of a thing that's going on all the time, even when I'm being self-critical, which is that my perspective on the world is through the lens of the self. Dearer than myself actually just means, I think, that I orient to everything through the lens of me. Oh, this is me. I like this, I don't like this. I'm afraid of this, I'm fond of this. And then it speaks to a layer that we talk about sometimes when we talk about the nervous system or the trauma physiology, that there's a kind of basic self-protective impulse that we carry, wear, perform, find happening by itself in us as animals. Where when there's threat, there's the responses of fight and flight, or freeze. When there's safety, there's the response of relaxing, settling, opening, restoring well-being. And these responses are not in our conscious control. You can't make yourself not be startled when you're startled. It's an animal response. You can't make yourself not be afraid when something scares you. It's just an animal response. If we understand this, the proposition is actually that the feelings that I have of criticizing myself, of disliking this one I perceive here, that those feelings are based in a delusion that somehow, like my being startled or afraid or frustrated or anxious, is somehow a fault of mine, that I've done something wrong, that I'm now anxious or that I'm afraid. Rather than saying, oh, this is the nature of the organism, that when threat comes, fear arises in relation to it. When safety comes, ease arises. Our culture says, oh, you're not happy, that's your fault. You didn't do the right things, or you didn't look the right way, or whatever it was. You weren't blessed with the beautiful person genes. More likely, you didn't buy the beautiful person genes. I can't afford beautiful person genes. I know. That pun is going to become more ironic now that the genome has been sequenced and you will be able to buy eventually beautiful person genes for your children. If that doesn't trigger fear and a self-protective response, you might let yourself be startled more by the possibility. Metta, as a quality of basic friendliness, proposes that the primary antidote to fear is kindness. The metta practice in the texts, in the commentaries, is said to have been given initially to a group of monks who wanted to go and do intensive practice, and they went to a forest grove that was said to be haunted by forest spirits. The tree spirits were angry, mean, didn't like people to come practice there. And so when the monks went there, in the night there were noises, and they were scared. The spirits kind of scared them away. And they went back to the Buddha, and they said, we went to practice in this forest grove, and we got scared because of the spirits there. And the Buddha said, oh, let me give you a practice. And the practice is to radiate or pervade the entire space around one with the feeling of kindness. And the formal phrase that teaches this practice says the meditator abides, meaning stabilizes the feeling or rests in or lives in, abides in the feeling of loving kindness, and pervades the whole direction to the north and the whole direction to the east and the west and the south with the feeling of loving kindness without limit, so out to the ends of your imagination or the ends of reality, excluding nobody, so all beings near and far, large and small, born and to be born, known and unknown, liked and disliked. So what is that as a practice? The monks were like, okay, that's a practice. They went back to the forest grove, and they began to practice, not just meditating on their own breath or their own body, but But generating the feeling of friendliness, of kindness, and then sending that feeling out in all directions. And we do that sometimes formally with the wish that we chant at the end of our sitting, may all beings be at ease, or may all beings be happy. So the monks just sat there, these guys in the forest, and they're just wishing, may all beings everywhere be happy. And one of the things that's beautiful in the text is it says that the devas, the spirits, they love metta. In other words, when we get happy and wish other beings happiness, when we get generous with our wish for happiness, the spirits they like that. And they kind of they come around, they cluster around, they make good things happen. The texts, the commentaries say that the spirits, they saw this happening and they were like, oh, this is really nice. and they decided to protect these meditators from like bandits, tigers, other spirits, who knows. And they made the grove, you know, a beautiful place to practice and really good energy, protected energy. And so metta, friendliness as a practice, the practice of radiating the wish for well-being, was not originally a practice for like healing self-loathing or the heart, how we sometimes use it now, but actually it was a practice first to defeat the feelings of fear. It's very hard to be afraid when you're happy, first of all, and when you're wishing everybody happiness. Wishing everybody happiness, of course, includes yourself, so it tends to make you happy to wish other people happy. Yes. But, so it's hard to be afraid of other beings when you're wishing them well. Right? So the Buddha comes in with a really nice antidote. He says, well, you don't want to be afraid. Do this instead. And it's a beautiful antidote because it doesn't say, conquer your fear. Face your fear. Feel the fear and like burn through it. Realize that nobody can hurt you or that you don't exist anyway and nothing can hurt you because life and death just fall. It wasn't that teaching. That's a nice teaching. But no, he said just go back to the grove and wish them well. And the deity and the forest spirits were like, oh, this is very nice. So metta is an antidote to fear for the practitioner. It's also a protection spell in a certain way, right? And you want to be protected, wish beings well. And then it turns out that it's a powerful vehicle for a couple of things. One is focus or concentration. The practice of metta or radiating kindness in various ways is actually one of the most popular methods for getting into deep meditative absorption used nowadays. The absorption is called jhana or dhyana. And so you can do this practice of wishing well to all beings, and the mind can get very concentrated, very focused. One of the secrets of concentration is that it's easier to concentrate when you're happy and relaxed, and you can't really force concentration. If you try to push away a spell of anxiety by using your will and saying, don't be anxious, you know, focus on the breath. Go away, anxious thought. It doesn't really work, right? It brings a kind of a whole layer of tension in. You can dispel them for a few moments, but your muscles get tired in a way, right? The mind, as a muscle, gets tired.
So do you want us to wish our anxiety well?
No. What I want you to do is ignore it and wish everybody else well. But it's a good question. If the anxiety were a demon haunting you, which it might be, you could wish that demon well. So it turns out that wishing beings well is a really good way to clear the mind of anxious and fearful thoughts. They can't coexist. Unfortunately, or fortunately for spiritual development, often when we begin this practice, we try to orient ourselves toward friendliness. We say, okay, I'm going to wish everybody well. I love everybody, and I love myself, and I love everybody. May you be well, may I be well, may you be well, may I be well. I have the best of intentions. I enter the practice of self-love and other love. And And students will come back to their teacher and say, I'm doing the metta practice. It worked great for about 20 minutes. And then, you know, I don't think it's going very well. So the teacher says, well, why not? And the person says, well, I'm so angry. Right? So here's part of practice. When we invoke or invite a feeling, sometimes it comes. But sometimes what comes is whatever was in the way of that feeling. Like the reason that feeling wasn't there is that there was something in the way. So metta is also what we would call a purification practice, right? You orient toward loving everyone, and what you'll find is, of course, the ways that that's hard to do. And for many of us, we orient toward loving ourselves, even with a very good intention. May I be well, may I be safe from harm. And the mind. Mind, why? The mind says, oh, you don't deserve that. Right? I'm not good enough for that. I have too many wounds, I'm not kind enough. People will come and say, how can I wish myself well when other people are suffering more than me? Shouldn't I just wish them well? Right? May all the refugees be well. May they indeed be well. May I also be well. Right? May all the people with worse trauma than me be well. It's true, may they be well. May I also be well. The rest of the verse that starts, I looked through the whole universe and saw no one dearer than myself. It goes on to say, therefore, one should turn outward and recognize that all beings have this same feeling. And the implication is everyone longs for safety. Everyone longs for freedom from stress. And so the metta practice, all of the heart practices, they hinge a little bit on a kind of projection that's a little bit universalist. And it basically says everybody's good. Everyone wants to be safe. And everyone's bad actions are basically the result of bad conditions. They're still trying to be well. We could use Christian language and say, so forgive them and love them. Or in Buddhist language, right? Everyone's suffering, may their suffering cease. And so metta is the practice of, again and again, because it's a purification, you have to do it a lot, reminding ourselves that our own worth is not dependent on our specific actions or the conditions we arose in or were raised in. It doesn't depend on our traumas, on how much healing we've done or not done. But just by being a conscious being, we are in the stream of pleasure and pain, and therefore can be wished well. And that everyone else is the same. This is a level of togetherness the texts propose that transcends any kind of difference. It says this includes all the deities, it includes the tree spirits, it includes people in all realms, animals, devils, demons, people behaving badly. In one of the traditional ways to practice metta, you start with people that are easy to love. Your teachers, your good friends, yourself. And once you get the feeling going, oh, I love those people, they're great, right? You start with the personal because you think that loving people depends on liking them. So you start with people you like. It helps. Like, oh, I like you. You whip up some love for them. Oh, you're good. I'm fond of you. And then you take that feeling and you kind of do a little quick shift. Sort of like the way that I sort of like try to quickly exchange, you know, like like a blunt stick for a sharp one in my baby's hand. And I'm like, you won't notice if I just sort of slip this one in. And he always notices. He's like, I wanted that one. And you can't take something out. He's just like, and I'm like, no, please take this nice one, you know. Take this kale stalk instead of this like open Sharpie. Right? But you know. So you do a quick shift. And the quick shift is you generate the feeling of love for people you like, and then you bring into the field someone who you call neutral. Right? The person who delivers your mail, the person who you don't really know, someone you see across the street. And you're like, oh, they want what I want. They don't want the exact things that I want, but they want the same general thing. Safety, freedom from stress, happiness. And then you point that feeling at them. May they also be happy. Because, of course, right? And you get good at that. You go back and forth. Say, oh, it's fading. And then you go back to your favorite people. And you go back to the neutral person. And then you're like, okay. And then you ratchet it up. And there's a great category called the difficult person. The difficult person. The person it's hard to like. Right? I did my first metta retreat, which was 7 weeks of all day, every day, no breaks, wishing people well. This is sort of intensive retreat practice, doing metta. I did it during the early years of the George W. Bush administration. So it was very easy. I'm admitting my politics here. Feel free to disagree with me on who your difficult person is. But I had a convenient difficult person. And so I spent about a week in there as the progression went on, wishing the president well. And it was a lovely thing to do. Lovely thing to do. You don't have to like someone to wish them well, and you don't have to agree with anything they do to wish them well. All you have to do is see them as a being. And maybe that's the thing, right, that creates peace, is actually seeing people rather than the veil of hating that comes in. Once you've practiced radiating kindness to neutral people and difficult people and people you like, the heart of the practice that we just jumped to today in our breathing version is simply to radiate the feeling to all beings everywhere. So all of that's fine. You're like, okay, loving people is good practice. It's an antidote to fear, creates the sense of safety. Why, again, then, is it so hard to love myself? And for so many of us, that's the gist. I talked about it as a delusion that we are, in a sense, identifying with details rather than the fundamental qualities. Part of that is the delusion of getting lost in the feeling of separateness. When I was a child, when I was in junior high or so, and now I think this is a racial reflection. I didn't think of it at the time. I really, really wanted my hair to be straight and sandy brown, not black and curly. And somehow I felt like that would do it. That would be the thing that would make me acceptable. I was undoubtedly wrong. I would have found something else. But that's what I sort of hinged it on for a moment. And whatever your thing is, right? Like, oh, I wish my belly was a little different than it is, or I wish my parts were different than they are, or my thing, or my voice, or the things that I say, or the things that I like, or, you know, whatever it is, your thing. There's some way that, like, we are able to it's almost like our lens gets both stuck on, in a really zoomed in aperture and can't zoom out, and then it has a sort of gravitational pull toward the thing we dislike for whatever reason, right? Here I am, you know, a fine young man. I've auditioned for and gotten the lead in Macbeth in seventh grade. I am Macbeth, the coolest role in the canon, right? Right? I am not only a tortured villain, but I get to die on stage at the end. This is the best thing ever. And I insist on thinking that I suck because my hair is curly. This is absurd and ridiculously common. How do we do that? How could I forget all of the good qualities that I have, that I was more often than not, is that true? I don't want to lie. That I was relatively often kind to my sister. Etc. So, part of what is asked of us in this path actually is a degree of waking up to the reality of, the full reality, as much as we can touch it, of who we are. And it's a little chicken and egg. The loving kindness practice can help us to see that. We just tell ourselves, I'm a sincere practitioner, I'm going for goodness, everything hurts, but I am a basically good person. Right? You can tell yourself that. That's the practice, essentially. And you have to also not just wish yourself well, but actually understand, this is a wisdom piece, this is an insight really into the nature of the self. You have to understand really what's happening. There's a degree of analyzing the mind, seeing the cuckoo-ness of the mind, and seeing, oh, look, there's that story, there's the record that says, you suck. Suck, you suck. And somehow the DJ keeps dropping the needle on that one. And you know, and not the one that goes, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Right. And then they weave together. And this is really what we would call, like, it's beautiful weave in the practice. This is why the practice is not just mindfulness, noticing things. But that there's a, see what's true, really investigate, and then be very kind in relation to that. And then see what's true, really investigate, and then be very kind in relation to that. And they just weave back and forth. So we'll pause there. Every being in the universe, basic goodness. May they be well. May I be well. May all beings be well. May we all know our place in the ecosystem, in the web of all things, and not forget the whole. Remembering the whole. So much easier to say, may this one here be well. So let's take just a moment to rest or sit in silence, noticing any ripples, and just letting it go. end with a list for pleasure. My teacher Sylvia taught me this list. From the texts, it says 11 benefits of practicing metta. I'll see if I can remember it. People who practice metta sleep peacefully, wake peacefully, have peaceful dreams. People love them. Devas love them, spirits. Devas will protect them. Poisons and weapons will not harm them. Their faces are clear. Their minds are at ease. They die peacefully. And when they die, they are reborn in the heaven realms. Thanks for listening so kindly. And in the sort of the last portion of our time together, we just take time to hear other voices, your responses, questions, reflections from your own practice. Anyone's welcome to speak.
So you mentioned, yeah, like, you know, you want to get to a level where you are sending kindness and love to somebody who's difficult. Is there any situation in which there's specific people that you don't want to be sending that to? Like, say somebody who caused you trauma.
The short answer is no. The question is, are there any situations like the perpetrator of a traumatic event that you would not want to send kindness to? The basic answer is no, but the longer answer is, you know, more subtle than that.
Yeah.
First of all, sending the wish for well-being doesn't in any way condone harmful action. So you don't have to forgive someone, you don't have to like them, and you don't have to ever see them again to send them kindness. In a way, it's a way of saying, wow, you were so hurt that you could do this. That's terrible. And in the process of healing trauma, that's a phase that isn't the first phase. And the first phase is might be like, you know, I hate you, you evil person, I want to blow you up. And another phase might be, you know, I don't know, there's a million phases, right? It's just like you have to re-access your self-protection and self-care and layer upon layer of re-finding the feeling of being protected and safe. And really the heart of trauma recovery is restoring the feeling of safety. So I wouldn't advise folks to take on, to put their perpetrator in the role of the difficult person. Maybe for a while, 10, 20 years, maybe, you know. First, use the president or someone, you know, relatively, use Donald Trump, for crying out loud, you know, whoever it is for you.
Well, because those, they're semi-real.
They're semi-real.
You know, unless you're spending time with George Bush or Donald Trump, you only know the... what you perceive.
Right, it's a stereotype, basically.
Yeah, from sources that are many layers from what's reality.
Absolutely. So in that way, it's a very safe, difficult person. Yeah. At a certain point, I decided that using George W. as my difficult person was a little too easy. And then I got all kind of psychological, and I put my mom in there. I was like, okay, mom, let's do this. You know? She I wasn't abused. She wasn't a perpetrator. She was just garden variety, difficult suburban mom, you know. But it was practice, you know. So in cases of trauma, you know, I would go really gently with it. And in a sense, I would imagine that in a certain way, it might never be necessary to put them in there. That's a different healing process. With guidance and, you know, in an appropriate therapeutic container, one might do that. Like, let's practice generating feelings of metta, the feeling of safety, and then just bring that person to mind and see what happens. And the system is going to bounce around and feelings will come. And all of that can be really part of the healing process, you know. And what might come is, of course, not kindness at all, but, you know, get the away from me, you bad person. And that's appropriate. You know? So the general answer is no, of course you can send them kindness. And the real answer is, you know, take care. Right? It's a good question. Thank you. What else?
I've been practicing Please. A version of this,
yeah.
which is the wounded child.
Mm.
Which has been intense.
For sure. For sure.
But it's very helpful. So it's like, I see my wounded child.
Yeah.
You know, you are safe. You yeah. were loved. You were at peace, basically, is the...
Yeah.
And yeah. it's been interesting because it's like, it feels like there's a battery that's too hot right there.
Mm. Yeah.
It's cool.
It's cooling. It's cooling. Yeah. Bless the cooling heat. Yeah. Yeah. This is purification practice, for sure. For sure, for sure. The definition of nirvana is cooling, right? That's a literal translation, right? It essentially says freedom comes when you separate the fire from its fuel, right? And the fuel is hatred, fear, and grasping. And the process... is a healing process.
Yeah. I mean, it's been good. It's been hard.
Yeah.
But yeah. it's been really helpful.
For sure. For sure. And it's, and I imagine it's changing as you do it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the guidelines for being able to send metta to yourself or almost anyone is to imagine them as a little baby, mm-hmm. right? You could take anybody, take the Trumps and Hitlers and whoever's of the world. And just imagine them as little babies. Like at some point, somebody had to hold them and nurse them and take care of them, or else they'd be dead. So there was some care there, and they hadn't become a jerk yet. And neither had you. That age. So this is part of that.
The funny part is, so I've been doing this, you know, around, you know, my family, basically.
Yeah.
My grandmother died, and it's brought up all kinds of family stuff.
Yeah.
And my picture of myself, my mental picture, is me probably around 6 or 7.
Yeah.
My uncle gave me this picture that he took of me at that age, and it is just spooky.
Uh-huh.
It is very much me at that age, and I'm not, like, happy kid. I'm a very... It's
the wounded child.
Child.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just like, he gave me that picture, and I was like, ooh.
Totally.
I have been seeing this little person inside
yeah.
for a while.
Yeah. For sure. For sure. Do you have other pictures of yourself even younger?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So that's not the only image,
no,
right,
no,
of course.
No, but that's the one that I had, it was just funny. It was like very similar to the one in my mind.
Yeah.
That I had been using already.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
It was a weird coincidence.
Right. For sure, for sure. Yeah, thank you. It's beautiful. Yeah, Stephanie.
So, I have a question about... I'm trying to think how to best put it.
Sure.
So I've, you know, I've been practicing a few years now, and I felt like I'd got a lot of metta practice in, and like a lot of tools under my belt that really empowered me to start taking on some difficult family dynamics. And
brave being that you are.
Yeah. And it was and it's still very present, but I realized that I was getting really overwhelmed, which shouldn't have been too surprising, but it was. And I was also, because I've been practicing all these things, I had this sense that I'm the only one I can trust to take this on, and I can't reach out to my family. And that's still hard for me to let go of, that I can't find support within my family because they're still caught in all the emotional disturbances, but I'm closer to not being so caught.
I mean, one question would be like, you know, not to immediately dismiss it, is that true? Because, of course, it might well be true on some level. And then on other levels, you're doing whatever you're doing. But do you have folks that can that could resonate with the process that you're in the family? Mm-hmm. Other folks you can trust to be more transparent with?
Maybe a few. It's really difficult for me to get there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. For sure. Just to in reflecting on it, thinking like, oh, I wonder, you know, there's a difference between the feeling I have to do this all myself and I can't trust anyone, and the sort of whatever actual means, you know. Oh, actually, you know, this brother or that cousin or this person mm-hmm. isn't actually part of the core of the distress and could do it, but I might not know that or connect with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah. Has it been helping practice in relation to figuring this out?
Yeah, it has. And in particular, I took a mindful communication seminar earlier this year, and that was really helpful. And actually, awesome. Through that, I found that people were just kind of naturally stepping up when I was able to just kind of relate to them more openly.
Look at that.
Which was nice. It's not consistent, and I think that's what bothers me, is like sustaining it.
Yeah. It's not consistent. Their response isn't consistent, or your practice isn't consistent.
Yeah.
So the reflection, of course, is that there's only one of those things you can do anything about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good luck with it. You've really, you know, any practitioner who says, "Ah, practice is going well. Let's take on the family dynamic," you know, is a practitioner with some chutzpah. So blessings always in that endeavor. One of my teachers says, oh yeah, in you know, the ultimate test of enlightenment, you know, to know like how liberated you actually are, is just to go home for Thanksgiving. And you see it. You know what's anything else, maybe one more, please.
I'm curious, when you mentioned purification, like as you're doing this metta practice, some like other feelings can come up. Like I heard you say anger.
Yeah.
Which is like actually a really big one for me. When I feel frustrated, it's just like this ball of frustration, but I am trying to just see other people as beings just like myself.
Yeah.
What do you recommend I don't know, get over those feelings that get in the way, that like come up and like are so prominent and real?
Yeah. You have to hang out with them. You have to be like, okay, frustration. What's frustration like? Oh, it's like my whole body's turned into like fiery yuck. And like, okay, fiery yuck. You need to hang out with fiery yuck. Basically, you have to feel it. Right. So whatever the story is that's causing it,
mm-hmm.
knowing that, but feeling it and allowing the feeling to, in a sense, like feelings are sort of like, they're like the wave part coming into the beach. You have to let it kind of crest and crash. And that means not trying to surf too big of a wave. So, you know, if you're getting a storm surge, you run for the hills. But if you're getting a soft wave, you kind of get into it and you get a little ride and you watch it settle. So what the metaphor really means, the wave metaphor, is that if you connect with it in the body in a small enough chunk, and you don't get lost in the story, it will naturally settle. And the nervous system information for this is simply that the stress hormones, we could say cortisol is the primary example, is secreted in the brain along with its own antidote, and it decays in the body in about 30 seconds. Meaning, if you get startled or stressed or afraid, and you don't do anything to get restartled, meaning thinking about the thing again, it'll pass in under a minute. And the main thing that we do is we don't let it pass by re-triggering it. We think about it again, and that's anxiety. So frustration is present, you notice it, log the thought, why, you know, I said half calf and I got full calf. The world is, people don't listen to me, what's happening? You log the story, and then you just tune into the body, and you take a moment, you hang out, and you're like, oh, you let it burn. Oh, burning is like this. And it fades. And you just do that. And basically you meet yourself in this simple kind of intimate way. Right? Stay as close to the body as you can. And if being close to the body is overwhelming or panic-inducing, then you get help to stay with the body. You do it with company. Yeah? But that's basically the pathway, is it has to be felt. You can't get rid of it without feeling it. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And that's the purification part, right? I'm trying to wish everybody well, but actually I'm pissed. Okay, so then be pissed, because you can't bypass it, right? You can pretend you're not pissed, and that's spiritual bypass, right? So just be pissed. It will pass. So we'll keep going. Maybe we'll keep going through the paramis. Maybe we'll go through the sequence of the four heart practices. Compassion would be next, and then joy, and then equanimity. Maybe we'll do that. I hope to see folks at our picnic. This group, as always, is offered in the challenging practice of the gift economy. So that means there's not a studio charge for class. These teachings were given to me, and I give them to you. And that gift is sustained by the gift of your resources that goes to the studio to help pay for the space and then half to me to help pay for baby food and childcare and things that enable me to be here. So thank you. As generous as you can be, supports others who can't be as abundant in their resources. So donations go in the basket there. And welcome to the new folks. We'll see you soon. Thanks for folding blankets neatly and taking care of yourself out there.